Hey, Jacob here. Before we start the episode, I just want to let y'all know that I have a book coming out. Woo! It's called How a Game Lives and is sort of an annotated anthology, a collection of my best essays covered in countless new thoughts and additions from me. Each essay will also have original art by a collection of supremely talented artists and brand new afterwards by some of the best writers in the game space, many of whom have already been guests on Something Rotten, like Noah Caldwell-Gervais or Renata Price or some guy named Blake Hester. You can pre-order the book now. Links in the podcast description. Welcome to a new season of Something Rotten. We're doing it. We're covering Disco Elysium. My name is Jacob Geller, and I am joined by a man who is playing Disco Elysium for the very first time, Blake Hester.
Jacob, my God. Listen, you might forgive me for having thought Disco Elysium was in fact a video game, since I had to get it on my partner's Nintendo Switch. Turns out, instead, it's an entire bookstore. It's worth of novels.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not one book. It's like 20 books.
Yeah, here I thought I was playing a fun game. I didn't know I'd have to learn. It's fucked up.
That's how it works. And to help in that learning, we have brought here someone who is not just my friend and a very talented YouTube video creator, but also someone who knows at least more than both of us about tabletop role-playing games and Dungeons and Dragons and stuff. Rasputin from the YouTube channel Rasputin is here.
Hello. It is me. Yeah, that's me. I'm Rasputin.
Thank you so much for joining us on this inaugural episode of probably the biggest thing that we've undertaken thus far. For the first year of this podcast, we kind of joked about doing Disco Elysium or not doing it because it was just so big. And then Blake said, let's just do it.
No. Let's give it up to the listeners. Money said, well, we can justify doing it now. Blake had little to say in it. That was the Benjamins that decided that one.
Raz, 2019 was a big year for the video essay scene because it's the year in which Outer Wilds came out. And it's also the year in which Disco Elysium came out.
Yeah.
Did you play it at the time on release?
No, I did not. I played when Final Cut came out, which was that 2021?
Yeah, that was like a good while later, I think.
It was definitely high on my recommended list. Everyone was saying you should play it. I had watched a bit of it and I knew I would like it, but you know how it goes. You have a billion games that you're supposed to play. and not enough time to play all of them. And I think also to Blake's point of an entire bookstore, it's hard sometimes to jump into a game like that you know is going to be so maybe demanding's the wrong word, but maybe it's also the right word of just needing to dive into it to understand everything it's trying to do. And also at the time, you know, that the original version didn't have any sort of voiceover. Not that a game needs to have that. Obviously, Outer Wilds is my favorite game. And you know, I had to read for that. What the heck? But, but definitely when the Final Cut came out, it was easier to be well, I can sit back and relax a little bit more while playing. So that was kind of the thing that pushed me over the edge to actually play it.
If I can just mildly correct you, the original game did, of course, have Chapo Trap House voicing various characters throughout the game. But yeah, your internal monologue certainly had no voiceover.
We're certainly going to talk about this game's affiliations later in the episode because I'm mad.
I remember when this game came out, it was a thing where I absolutely did not hear anything about this game pre-release. I did not know that it was coming out. I hadn't heard anything. I mean, this wasn't a genre that I was keyed into. You know, basically, I knew that Noah Gervais loved Planescape Torment, and I would see that game kind of pop up on best written games ever. But I had never played a CRPG. I wasn't really interested in doing so. And I think it was Scott Benson, the creator of Night in the Woods, or, you know, one of the creators of that game, who at some point just started tweeting about it and started tweeting about, getting into a nodding argument with someone that went on long enough that his player's, neck cracked and he died. And I was like, I should... I should check out this game. But it might have been early 2020 for me or something that I played it. And Blake,
what's up, baby?
You're playing it now.
I am. You know what? Here's the thing. I have this horrible habit where a game comes out and all my friends are like, Blake, this is the new jam. You're going to love this thing. And I'm like, yeah, but like, what if I played, I don't know what an equivalent would be.
The Darkness 2.
No, in 2019, what would it be like? Yeah, but what if I played Horizon Zero Dawn, a game I hate, and then I play 50 hours of that game? And I'm like, oh, well, that wasn't fun. I guess I won't play anything else for 3 months. And I'm still that way. Believe it or not, there's so many games I don't play. Instead, I play garbage all day. But it has, like, this game has a big shadow over it, or casts a big shadow, I should say. Because
it's also got a shadow over it, which we'll probably talk about.
Yeah, right,
different things.
But, like, because it hits so hard, which is very surprising for it, genre, that, like, it was one of those games I increasingly felt bad for having not played. You know, being like, oh, this is just, like, this is a big deal in the industry I ostensibly cover as a professional. You could argue my merits as a professional, sure, but nevertheless. But now that I finally got to it, I'm like, oh. Y'all weren't kidding.
I think one of the things that happens with Disco Elysium, as happens with like a lot of art that really strongly connects about people or connects with people, is we talk about it in these unbelievably grand terms that actually kind of don't communicate what the game is very well, because we're like, oh my gosh, it changed my life, it's the best game ever written, whatever. And it's like, when you start, it's like, it's a game about, like, a drunk cop who says, I want to make fuck with you, to literally the first person that he meets. And it's like, I feel like pitching it like that maybe makes it a little more approachable than pitching it as, you know, the greatest literary achievement in gaming.
Nah, you know what I think it was on my end? Is there games that come out where it's like, it's easy to push them to the side? I've heard other people talk about this before. Where it's like, well, I know I'll love that, so I'll just play it eventually. And I think Disco was one of them. Outer Wilds is another one. I've never played Outer Wilds because it's like, oh, no, I'm going to love it. So I'll just get to it when
You should probably play Outer Wilds.
Yeah, Kentucky Route Zero was one of those, and then I did eventually play that. Though I never finished it. But I think that was the issue. It's like, well, I know I'm going to love it, so there's no risk here. You know, there's nothing. I can just get to it when I'm ready to really love something, which doesn't make any sense. But I think that's why I put it off for so long. It's like, I'll play the game I love when I get to it.
You know, I think that is almost a Disco Elysium-esque sentiment, in that it's like avoiding the things we know will bring us happiness out of some like bizarre risk-seeking behavior.
But here's the thing. I truly did not expect how dense it would be from the get-go. Here's maybe a conversation we'll need to have playing this game in 2024 with the Twitter brain poisoning I have. Too dense? Should they edit some of these words out? Whoopee. It's hard, Jacob. I am curious, how deeply should I be following the lore and like the geographical lore of Revachol? Like, this is one of my big challenges I want to talk about early, is like, they get so, it reminds me of Dishonored in a way, where the world is so much bigger than anything you actually see. And I'm like, do I really need to know what's southwest across the ocean from Revachol? Do I need to know that? Is that important? But they talk about it for 15 minutes. I need to know?
Right. Well, this is, Raz, I want to get your perspective on this as someone who has, like, ran various D&D and similar, like, role-playing game things before. Like, have you invested a lot in, like, creating worlds for your players? Is that something that you like doing?
Too much, yeah. Way too much. So I guess my main history of running a game, I ran a very long, like, 4-year campaign with like 80 plus sessions. It was a long thing, and I built out not a whole world, because who has time for that, but you know, a major country with many different cities and different cultures in those cities, that most of it they never even went to. But I had it in case they did. I had it. And I don't know, I think you want your world to feel full when you're running a game. because if they ask a question about something, because that'll always happen, is there will be a random question that they're like, well, what's it like in this place that you hadn't thought about? But if you have thought about it and have an answer, then you just look like a genius and you feel good about your world.
Yeah, I feel like that is essentially what my guess is, that what you're referring to, Blake, is like almost the first moment that you step out into the city, you get a call from Shivers, which is one of the skills that you have, and you can just say, what's to the north, what's to the east, what's to the west, and you can like keep going, and there is a colossal amount of description there, and like the basic answer is like, it does not matter what it says. I think it matters that it said it, you know. And there is a lot of kind of washing over you that the text in this game can do, but I think it's not in a way where there's like too much of it. It's just like, if I open an encyclopedia and it was blank, I would think that was weird. I can open it and know it's full of stuff that I'll like never learn, but like the fact that it's full makes the world feel, you know, full and interesting.
Right.
Also great for lore YouTubers, you know, just...
yeah.
Gotta get a couple of videos out on this, you know? What is north of Revachol?
Yeah, a whole cottage industry. So this podcast is going to be structured a little differently than the ones that we've done in the past, because it is so... this game is so nonlinear in how you can experience the events in it that even deciding what our stopping points were going to be was very challenging. And I talked about this with friend of the show, Renata Price, who loves Disco and has spent way more time with it than even me. What we are going to do, just for people who are playing along, is this first episode, it stops at the end of the first day. You go to bed, you have a dream. That's the stopping point here. The next episode is going to stop at the end of day three, wherever that is in the story. The third episode is going to end after the confrontation in the main square, which is something that you will recognize when you get to it. And then the fourth one will be the end of the game. There are a lot of different orders in which events can happen in that, and some things might happen for some of us and not for others at all. And Blake is the one here who hasn't played it, and so, like, I am interested in the order, Blake, in which you experience things, because I don't want to talk about stuff that I did in the first day, because sure, you might not get there until day three, and you, I know, went places that I did not in my playthrough here.
Okay, well, at the very least, as I talk through it, if we have overlap, please jump in and tell me about your experience. If we
went to the
same area. Okay, sure.
And because it's like I'm doing a specific run through this time, but I've played through it enough that I think I've seen not most of it, because there is an infinite amount of this game, but mm-hmm. I have some idea. What is your? You told me that you were like playing a character.
Yes,
Blake. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
Well, folks at home may or may not know, I am indeed an alcoholic in recovery, and I was not going to play this game as a drunk. I was going to play this game as a man who wanted to recover. Frankly, I'm very uninterested in what this game, how they portray an active alcoholic. You can tell me it's good, but I just don't care. I was very interested in how they tackle recovery, which, as far as I'm concerned, is way more difficult to do tactfully. So my character is unfortunately a cop, but, you know, can't play the game without accepting that fact. But I am playing a man who still doesn't know his name. Think it might be Harry? Unclear. Who woke up and realized, like many good men have, they have fucked their whole life up. And if they don't do it now, they will certainly die trying, at least. And so everywhere I'm going, I am apologizing when I can. I'm becoming the sorry cop, which I don't think I quite yep. want. Mm-hmm. I think I'm trying to get out of that hole, but and also trying to approach my investigation with empathy, assertiveness, without aggression, and also understanding for the people of what appears to be a tumultuous city in the midst of a lot of bureaucracy, violence, and a third adjective. So that's the character I'm playing. Right. A man who does not want to be the man he was yesterday.
I think that sounds great. That is pretty similar to how I think I approached my first playthrough. Yep. In that, like, it sounds like you are trying to be good, you know, like a good person, generally, given your circumstances. What like archetype did you choose at the beginning? Because you have kind of the brainy one, the sensitive one, and the like physical one. Or you can make your own, but I'm assuming you chose one of those three.
By God, I have a picture of it. Thank you, Past Blake. Sensitive.
Nice.
Very psychological. A magnetic personality, but unstable. Might begin to lose his mind. And I said, if that ain't my ass, I tell you what.
Rez, do you remember how you first approached the game?
Well, so my very first time, I did a custom one that was very, like, most of the mental stats, right? And very, very few strength ones. I think, like, whatever gave you your health, which I'm struggling to remember at the moment, like, whatever that stat was as low as it could go.
All right, so you have, like, one health point?
Yeah, yeah. And I died grabbing the necktie. And then I was like, this game's on to something. This game's got something. So, yeah, I died and then had to start over. And then I just made a more balanced one where I wouldn't get killed immediately.
I will say the one piece of advice I had playing this game came from my beautiful roommate, AJ Moser, who said, Blake, leave the tie on the fan. And I had no clue what that meant, but I followed his advice and later asked
AJ, what the fuck, dude? Bad advice.
I later asked him and he told me what that was all about. And I was like,
no, go get that tie.
No, not at this point. Hell no.
Okay. So so you have the choice to kind of start with these different builds or make your own. And I think one of the things that you were messaging me about was, like, the actual mechanics of this game, the RPG mechanics, are pretty opaque. Like, it is hard to tell what's going on from the beginning. And also, I should say, to kind of jump off on my own journey, because this is something rotten, I am doing a racist fascist run through of this game. I am playing the kind of character that I would never play unless it was kind of motivated by something like this, of just kind of making all the worst decisions and really taking the opportunity to be fascist whenever the game gives it to me, which I've never done before, and I am kind of morbidly interested in how it's going to go.
Yeah, that opaqueness is really interesting, because on the one hand, the game feels inscrutable at times when I load up a menu sheet, and I'm like, what the fuck does any of this mean? On the other hand, it's really compelling, right? Like, I thought, as I do with most games now, as I was playing Disco Elysium, my mind went back to Silent Hill 2. And the way that game just dumps you and is like, figure it out, bucko. And I really appreciate, like, the way the opening of this game does lend to the roleplay of the moment of a guy who has woken up. I can't remember what the term the game uses for the specific amnesiac he is. But it's like a man who literally has forgotten the world he lives in. And I love the idea that the game, like, it does have a tutorial that occasionally will talk to you, but, like, I was really compelled by just, like, in the moment, having all these various buttons and sheets and things going on that the game was just like, your problem now. Fucking figure it out. Like, I was super into that.
Okay, so another, so the kind of, I don't think we're going to talk too much about the development of this game because it's well covered elsewhere. You should go see the People Make Games video about it to learn all about the tumultuous both development and ownership rights and everything to this. But it is important to know that, like, the origin of the world was Robert Kurvitz and his kind of, like, group of artist friends made a role-playing game first in this world that they just kind of dreamed up when they were drunk. Then Kurvitz wrote a book set in the world, which sold very poorly. And then they made this game, which was set in the same thing. And so it was, like, initially designed as a D&D game, which is really interesting to think about. And it makes it so that the kind of, like, fiction of the world is totally, Raz, what you were doing of, like, coming up with cultures mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. case someone asks about them. But the way that skills work in this and, like, personality traits is really fascinating. And I assume I've never really played D&D to any, you know, for any significant amount of time. Raz, there are no, like, there's not, like, dexterity or anything in this game, right? Like, all the skills, I'm assuming, are, like, very different from skills in most TTRPGs.
Well,
I guess there maybe is dexterity, but it doesn't work in the same way.
Yeah. Well, like, there's the four main stats, which I have looked up to remember them. Intellect, psyche, physique, and motorix. Motorix? Is that it?
Sure.
Dexterity is what you could call it. So it's like, it's got those four main stats, but then there are whatever, like 24 or so other, like, you know, all the various things that you actually make rolls for.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that are all personified too, which is a huge departure from Dungeons and Dragons, right? In D&D, if you make a nature check, it's like, how in tuned are you to nature? Which I guess has some similarities, but it's not like nature actually is like, there's a squirrel that's dead in the corner over there, you know?
Nature's not like, you fucking idiot.
So, you know, I would definitely say, like, all the different, I guess what I'll say are skills instead of stats. Like, the skills in Disco Elysium are quite different from anything that's in Dungeons and Dragons, which is far more like, you know, a survival check or an athletics check or an acrobatics, opposed to shivers, right? This is just what the city speaks to you and whatnot. There's really nothing like that in D&D.
And I think something that took me a long time to kind of figure out what the game was doing is the idea that it is constantly rolling for things that you don't even know it's checking for. You know, that, like, you will often get very visible checks where it says, hey, you know, like, try not to throw up. And then you will either pass that or fail that, and you see mm-hmm. dice on the screen. But, like, even when you don't see that, there are just, like, little invisible checks for, are you even going to notice this? And, like, if, you know, if your visuals or whatever are high enough, then you will. And sometimes it tells you that you, like, failed it. But also sometimes you, like, don't even know that there's a skill that you passed or failed. Because it's just, it's kind of doing all the work for you in the background, which I think is really interesting and makes playing the game, like, much smoother than it could be. Blake, when voices started talking to you, were you like, these are my skills? You know, like, what was your impression of that?
Well, for real heads, you who might have read the third issue of the Game Query Zine, where Jacob wrote an open letter from the limbic system, it made that make a lot more sense. I was like, oh, that's what that was. I edited that and ran it. Had no clue what it meant. No, I had no clue. That whole system is a deep mystery to me. I have, like, the game is so opaque at times that, like, it didn't even occur to me I should open up my character sheet for at least a couple hours and, like, look into that thing. I've only really begun kind of, like, you know, dumping skill points into it and, like, thinking about how I want to, like, build the character further than just the beginning of the game when I selected an archetype. But I don't know if it's a cop-out answer. I think the voices are narratively very interesting. What is going on with them right now is completely lost on me. I don't know if that is something that by the end of the game I'll be an expert in, or it would require a second playthrough to fully understand. But, like, hearing about these invisible roles that you just said, I was like, I had no fucking clue that was happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, I think it's something that we can talk about, because it's not like a twist. You know, it's not like you're going to find out that, like, oh, the voices are like a different person who's talking to you. Like, I think the kind of the general concept of the game is, like, these are all possible elements of your personality. And you basically, you have the option to make some of them louder. You know, and what you, I think, the, like, the best advice in terms of, like, leveling up and investing skill points I can give is, like, what voices do you want to hear more from? Mm-hmm. You know, like, sometimes it will say, you know, like, sometimes there'll be a rhetoric check and you can't pass it. And so then you will think, I should put another point into rhetoric so I can, like, try that thing again. But because this game is so big on you failing things as much as succeeding, trying to make, like, a well-rounded character kind of isn't the goal here. And I think one of the ways that the game, like, tricks you into role-playing no matter what you're trying to do is, like, you just, if you like Shivers, put more points into Shivers. You know, like, if you like composure or drama, put points there because, like, you're going to miss things, and so you should just kind of decide what you like and lean into
Okay, that's good to know, because I think my approach was just, like, make a well-rounded character. Like, I would start dumping points into things I needed in the moment, which I'm sure I'll still do to some degree, but I did not think about, like, I don't know, considering which voices I like in my head. There's a, I really want to get an ice cream freezer open right now, and so I'm like, yeah, I gotta pump up my strength. But it's not, like, the one I would do naturally. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, and I also think it's okay if you want to open that freezer to put points into strength. But, like, you know, those are basically the different reasons that you would level up. It's either you want to do something or you want to, like, hear more from someone.
Sure. So, do you want to hear a bit more about my first day?
Oh, baby. Tell me.
All right, so I wake up. I take 30 minutes to figure out the game is telling me to put my clothes on. It was really a journey, being like, what the fuck am I doing? I go out and I meet the first character, and her little icon shows up, and I was like, that's who Dasha Nekrasova played.
That's right.
I was like, there's no other. I fact checked myself, but I was like, yep, there's no way there isn't that. Immediately I was just confuddled by what was happening. This woman telling me, man, you sure are a wild one. And I was like, well, what if I said I want to make fuck with her? What would happen? Luckily, she was not horrified and did not kill me, as she should have. But it was from there that I think I decided the role play.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the opening minutes of this game are so confusing. And the temptation of saying I want to make fuck with you is so strong that I just went for it. But it, like, as she goes back in her hotel room, you can, you know, make the choice to try to get in there or not. I think after I did all that, which it really seems like the game is, like, pushing you towards doing, I was like, no, actually, like, this is not who I want to play. So it was, like, from that moment that I decided the role play. So then I go about the experience I think every person will have, where you go down, you talk to Garte. I'm not sure how you pronounce that dickhead's name. That dude fucking sucks. He's so annoying. I go down there and I start piecing together, like, oh Lord, Harry, we've all been here, brother. I was like, this is a nightmare. And it was interesting as a person in recovery to want to play the guy who has woke up and immediately regretted everything he has done to these people, even the stuff he can't remember, which in Harry's case is everything. And to get resistance, right? Like, I think in a lesser written game, people would be like, you were really bad, but then you picked the right dialogue choice, and they're like, but it's okay, bud.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And Gart, like, at least in the 5 hours I've played, that dude has not come around on me. And there's another person who works in the Whirling and Rags, a woman that you call on the phone, who is just like, fuck you, I like...
Oh, yeah, Sylvie?
Yeah, she's like, I quit my job because you sucked so bad. And I'm like, no, I'm deeply sorry. And she's like, I don't care. And I thought that was, like, very narratively interesting, right? I thought that was very compelling. And so as I'm going on my forgiveness tour, or my apology tour, I should say, the amount of resistance I was getting from the game both emboldened me to keep trying, but also fascinated me that the game was not giving me the satisfaction I thought it would, of being like, it's all good, buddy, don't worry about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I met Kim Kutsuragi, which I think is a reference to Ken Kutaragi, the former head of PlayStation. The name is very, very similar, and I think that is the reference there. We can get into more of the name references in this game, because one made me almost quit the game. And there was, like, a brief moment I was like, I'm not gonna tell this dude what's going on. I'm a ruse him. And then that immediately was the hardest and insurmountable task. And I was like, look, I got to level with you, Kim. I'm a big dumb idiot right now. I don't know what the fuck's happening. Both me as the character in this game and me as the player, we are two lost sheep in the woods right now.
Oh, something that I deeply love about the game that is present from the very beginning is how your dialogue choices are, or even like the thoughts you're thinking, how the choices are written. And one of my favorite is Kim asks, is the body still, or like, did you get the body down from the tree? And one of your choices is, look, man, you know, yeah. You know, like, that's how it's written out. And Kim's like, so the body's still in the tree.
It's, you know, that is actually something I don't think I expected from this game, was how funny it would be. Like, actually very funny.
Oh,
even
yeah.
Even when a lot of the, like, more humorous dialogue choices are not the ones I'm gonna pick, because it just, like, doesn't work for my character. Like, still just reading the brief little things, I'm like, that's a good fucking bit. None come to mind, unfortunately, off the top of my head. But, like, I did not know the game was funny.
I think we tried to tell you this. I'm sure that I...
You tell me lots of things, Jacob. I can't remember them all. I don't know if y'all want to jump in from here and talk about the opening of your playthrough, but that is very much, I was just confused.
Yeah.
In the whirling and rags. I also probably spent an hour in there, I should add. I was investigating everything.
One of the things that I feel like that the game design wise is interesting about this is, you know, when you think kind of games where you make dialogue choices, a lot of times it is, you know, Mass Effect or something, where it's like there's transparently the good one and the bad one, and then there's kind of like the middle of the road one. And Disco not only like does not really have those, I think the game is trying to push you in towards like choosing strange options. Like, one of the loading bar tips is literally like, you're a cop, so people will be more forgiving for you like saying offbeat things. Did you, in your first playthrough, or, you know, revisiting it now, like, are you trying those weird things? Are you trying to still kind of be, like, Paragon? You know, what, do you think the game is successful in getting you to, like, play a bizarre character?
Well, to a degree. I mean, I was the sorry cop, too, but not because I was role-playing, just because I'm from the Midwest, you know? It's just, like, that's a natural thing. I think a compliment Disco Elysium gets a lot, and that I would put on it as well, is it is the closest a video game has felt to like a tabletop RPG, like actually playing with friends and playing a real game. It's the closest a video game, because there's just so many barriers that exist for games, because they cannot read your mind. They cannot fully react to your 100% unique idea. You know, they have to be their pre-written thing. And that just is a barrier that makes it impossible for it to have the full freedom of a tabletop RPG. But I think what Disco Elysium does really well, that like Mass Effect definitely doesn't do, comes with the various narrators, whether it be through just the stats or just whatever else, that comment on what you are doing, that judge what you are doing. You know, and I think that is what feels like a game master, whether it be in D&D or anything else, because that person is usually going to be the one that, not necessarily in a mean way, but usually in a funny, joking way of like, oh, so your character is doing this, you know, and then just list the wildest, weirdest thing that someone chose to do. And like, everyone laughs and it feels good. And I think Disco Elysium does that as a game when you make a choice. And then it's like, hey, you're an idiot. You know that, right? And that kind of makes you want to be an idiot because the game points out how funny it is. I think the way I played was mostly that Paragon sort of thing. But every once in a while, there would be that tempting option, like Blake pointed to, of, you know, that you're just like, I have to see. Because they thought to put this in the game. Yeah. So I have to see. And then it always paid off with some funny remark or just interesting remark by the various stats that are like, what are you doing, man?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because like the moment I decided I loved this game was the moment like temptation got the best of me and I had to break away from my character in the bookstore and I ripped a curtain open, which is like not the character I was playing. But I was like, I can't ignore the temptation any longer. I have to give in. And the reward for that was like an hour and a half of my favorite shit of this entire section, which we can get to. But like, I like that you brought up, like, sometimes you just have to kind of go mask off because like the choice is so tempting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think like that also works with the character. It's like your guy has poor impulse control, even if you're trying to be good. There are several of those in the opening section. One of them is like before you even leave the hotel, you can try and just run away from Gart when he's telling you about like the hotel fee that you owe, mm-hmm. and like the failed check, which you'll probably get because all of your stats are like rock bottom at the beginning, is you like flick him off and dive backwards and run into Lena, who's like the woman in the wheelchair, and it's like so catastrophically bad right off the bat. I tried in my playthrough this time, there's the option to arrest him when he's telling you how much you owe, and you're just like failing authority checks all over the place. And there was a thing where he said, "You can't arrest me," and my failed check was me saying, "I very well fucking can, bitch." And then and then he's like, "No, you can't. You still owe me this money," which is great.
I'd like to point out, it took me the entire day, but I did pay off my debt. Nice. Right before the day switched over.
I'm really okay. I had something happen with this that I've never had happen before. So where did you get money from?
Well, so I was picking up money everywhere, but that only amounted to 9 real, which I guess is the equivalent of $9 USD. But I found a woman on a boat who works with the Pine Woods or something. She said a lot, and it was 11 p.m., and I was like, oh, God, I missed a lot of that. But at one point, she's like, I've been ignoring a lot of the prompts that are like, can I borrow money from you? Because I was like, it just doesn't seem like the character I should borrow money from. But like, I run into her, and I was like, I don't really give a fuck about you, lady.
No, she's the fucking neo-lib. You absolutely should borrow money from her.
I was like, you duped me into doing your investigation for you. Like, I'm mad about that. I messed up. Kim was like, ask her weird questions so we can throw her off. I messed all that up. So I was like, come on, God, fuck this lady. So I was like, hey, can I borrow money? And she was like, yeah, of course. And then it gave me like the prompt to borrow exactly what I needed for the thing. I almost was like, give me 1,000 real. Like, let's go. But I was like, 130. That's all I need. And she gave it to me. I paid off my debt. It was awesome. I was so stoked on that. Not a big fan of that lady, though.
Rez, do you remember how your first day went in terms of money gathering?
Similar problem of doing a lot of what I thought was a lot of work and, you know, having no money.
Yeah, like
and
picking then up the bottles and you get like 5 cents per bottle.
Yeah, I don't remember the full process of how it happened, but I Kim helped me out. I think we took his hubcaps.
Yeah. Okay. This is what I want to talk about because I was at first committed to being like, I am going to sleep on the street. Like I'm not going to do this. And I don't think that's an option, but I just kept saying, I have no money. I have no money. Even when I did, which was, I was like, I'm playing a fucked up character, so I felt bad, but I was like, I don't have money. And then this thing that I had never got before, which is Kim is like, God damn it. Okay. I have something. And you go to his car and did you find the thing? Like, did you learn about Kim and cars? Because this is one of the...
No.
Like, when you're just opening up his car and you get, like, the tools out of it and you use the radio, there's a thing where you turn on the radio and it's on, like, an extremely aggressive talk radio about cars where it's like, all right, and here we are, go fast on the dial and we're gonna... And it's, like, very embarrassing and Kim is clearly, like, not happy that you heard that, but it's like... He likes cars, you know, he's proud of his car, whatever. Yeah. And so if you don't have money at the end of the day, he's like, fuck, okay, I confiscated these hubcaps, essentially, these like really nice hubcaps. And then the department said they didn't need them as evidence. So I don't know, I guess we can pawn them. And I felt so bad because it was clearly like, He was kind of like, well, what was I going to do? Put him on a police car? That's stupid. But like, you could tell he wanted to keep them. But instead, I made Kim pawn his hubcaps so I could pay for the hotel.
Holy yeah. shit. Wow. Yeah, I just borrowed money from that old lady that looked like Professor McGonagall.
Right. Yeah, Raz, you also felt bad?
Yeah, I felt very bad about that. Because, I mean, Kim...
Yeah, let's talk about Kim.
Kim is Kim, right? Kim is an easily likable character, you know, being a cop aside. And it's just like he's trying so hard to help you, even though you don't deserve it. Even I think even when you're playing the best version of your character, you don't deserve the grace and help that Kim
yes.
is consistently giving you. And yeah.
I agree. I think it is an interesting move for the game to give you Kim. And I think it's very generous, you know, that they give you this character who is so unflappable and so kind of undeterrable that he's not going to tell you to, like, fuck off and leave you even when you are doing, like, the terrible things that you will inevitably do accidentally or on purpose in this game. And, like, me playing the, like, racist fascist playthrough, it's interesting, like, how kind of, like, his character is written in a way where he can either be kind of like professionally warm from a distance or professionally cold from a distance. And they don't have to change that many lines, you know, because he is just like, he is pretty calm. He is collected. He is unflappable. And so you can just kind of have in your head, he kind of likes me or he kind of hates me, but like he stays basically the same with just, like, I know that he hates that I subscribe to Measurehead's theory of race, but, like, you know, he's not going to let it get in the way of the mission.
Dude, nothing feels better than when you're playing this game and you have a detective thought that, and Kim's like, oh, shit, that's kind of,
yep.
that's kind of smart. I'm like, yes, bro, yes. And the one moment in my day one when Kim got mad because we were talking to the racist lorry driver, and, like, you don't even build up to it. Like, I was like, oh, I guess I'll go talk to this guy. And Kim's like, hey, what's up, you racist fuck? I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, when he breaks character, it's so good.
That conversation is really interesting because what the dude says is, welcome to Revachol. And Kim immediately is like, hey, you fucking asshole. I was born here. And it is this, like, I think it's the game really... You know, the game does racism in a whole lot of different ways. You know, you get characters who are kind of overtly racist, like Measurehead, who is this whole, like, has this whole theory of the different race superiorities. And then you also have the racist lorry driver who's just kind of, like, smarmy about it. Who, basically, him saying welcome to Revachol is, like, being, you know, like, seeing a random Indian guy and being like, hey, where are you born? You know, where he's just like, I know you're not local is basically the implication. And Kim's like, no, I am. I'm from here. And also, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. I'm not sure who Measurehead is.
Measurehead is the dude on the big doors who's like guarding the button.
Oh, I haven't talked to him yet. Yes, okay. But he is one of my... things I want to... I heard he has some tattoos.
He's got a lot of ideas.
Someone told me he's got tattoos.
He sure does.
I've been curious about some tattoos. So when I walked out of Whirling and Rags, a couple things happened that I found surprising. One, as I went to call my station to figure out who I am, and they started calling me this name, and, you know, I had... Outside of the choices made in Disco Elysium, as a real human being, I had to make a choice, and that was... Do I follow my morals and turn this game off and never play it again? Or do I begrudgingly accept what is hidden in the text of this game? So I go and I'm like, look, man, I'm sorry. I've lost my gun, lost my badge. I have lost my perception of what it means to be a human being on this planet. And they call me Dick Mullen. And right there, I paused the game and I said, Dick Mullen, you mean to tell me... And this game, so closely associated with the Dirtbag Left, which is really a stain against its entire credibility, as far as I'm concerned, having once had Dasha and the damn Chapo Trap ass and this shit. You mean to tell me one of the biggest fictional characters in this universe is a direct reference to the former co-host of Cumtown, Nick Mullen? My nemesis, these three men from come down. I was so furious that that was in this game. Because, look, we can't give him this. Jacob, you didn't even realize.
No, you, and
this reference went over your head.
Renata messaged me about this. And was like, is this an... And telling her, because she did not know the Chapo connection, I felt terrible. Because it's like, this is like her favorite game ever. And it was like, yep. She had like a crisis of being like,
yeah.
Wait, I did not realize that this was part of this game.
Now look, I don't know specifically what my beef with Cumtown is, other than it's not funny. However, I do have an immense beef with them, and when I catch them on these fucking streets. Well, it's impossible to know because they look like everyone in Brooklyn. It's about this is not a bit. I think I see Adam Friedland at least once a week, and it's just a guy in Brooklyn because that's what my partner lives in Williamsburg. I'm like, holy shit, is that Adam Friedland? Yeah, I was pretty upset about this. Have they talked about the Dasha connection at all? Because I think when she was in this game, it was before she went full. Like,
yeah,
ironic.
No, she was
alt-right.
She had the famous clip where she was dressed as Sailor Moon doing like Sailor Socialism, and you know, like,
well, it's not Sailor Moon, but yes, I get your point.
But wasn't that what they? Because her
just
name
a sailor
was like
outfit.
Outfit. That's right. Okay,
Sailor Moon's in like a schoolgirl outfit.
Right. Okay, you're right.
But, like, what is the reason they dropped her off? Because I heard it was, like, some SAG stuff. Because she ended up being, like, a fairly popular actor as well because of Succession. But, like, it feels like they kind of painted themselves in a hole with a lot of the associations before the, like, final cut.
I don't know. A lot of them were just, they just replaced them with professional voice actors, you know.
Well, Dasha's an interesting one because she is famous.
Yeah, and
like, it's a choice to not use her.
I do think... Also, I think she did a pretty good job in that original game. Like, her voice performance was pretty good. I have no idea.
A terrible person.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to, like, play this game and see the remnants of what must have been, like, a wink and nod in 2019 to some of these podcasts and, like, dirtbag left groups.
Something that I talked to Renata a little bit about that I'm keeping an eye on is the, you know, dirtbag left is such a nebulous term that, like, we're just kind of talking about podcasts that we find annoying or whatever. But, like, one of the perspectives of, if you want to talk about the dirtbag left as an ideology, like, one of the places that I am particularly frustrated with them often is about race, because the way that they talk about race is essentially, like, it's secondary to class, you know, all conflict is class conflict, and essentially, if we achieved perfect communism, like, you know, all aspects of racism and white supremacy would just go away because they're all just, like, you know, given to us by the bourgeoisie, which I think is, like, a very limited understanding of how race operates and whatever, and mm-hmm. also kind of leads them to make fun of any attempts to dismiss racism that is not explicitly about, like, establishing communism. And so, like, with that in mind, it's something that I'm looking for this playthrough that I haven't really before, of, like,
sure.
how does this game deal with all that? And it's just, like, I don't know, it is an interesting perspective to have. I think this game is in general very politically canny, and I you know, even though it lets sure. you do a lot of things, you can kind of tell what, you know, what its ideology is. And generally, I agree with it, but it is, it's just, like, it's something I'm looking out for.
It is interesting the way the dirtbag left over the years, as they got more and more disfranchised, did birth the Dime Square movement, which loves to get off on, like, ironic bigotry.
Yep.
Which, like, Red Scare is just, you know, the pioneers of being like, well, we used to be somewhat cool, now we're racist and love to use ableist slurs. And I don't understand it. But, you know, Disco couldn't foresee that.
Vraz, aren't you glad that we brought you on for this discussion in particular?
Yeah, I have never listened to Cumtown.
Oh, my God.
Congratulations.
So, I am vaguely familiar with a few of these names. But, yeah. But, I mean, I generally, you know, I think I do wonder about the affiliation. Is it, like... you know, did the creators of the game, were they fervent listeners of these things? Or was it more of like how you follow someone on Twitter and it's like, oh,
yeah,
Stavros tweeted at me, man. This guy's hilarious. You know, like, yeah, you'd never know. And then it's like, hey, let's make a online connection with them. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not going to say it's worth doing a deep dive into, sure, the relations to the dirtbag left. But it is interesting to wonder how much of this was just like how Twitter often works of or the online works. Yeah.
Yeah. Of just kind of like they, you know, they needed voice actors for this game, you know, they, whatever.
To be fair, I don't think any of the Cumtown guys were in the game. There's just references to them by name. Yeah. The Chapo guys were in it. They seem more on the up and up overall than Cumtown, which I find pretty annoying.
And we should also say, you know, for people who aren't aware, the creators of this game are explicit communists, and at the Game Awards thanked Marx and Engels in their speech, which is the only good thing that's ever come out of the Game Awards.
There is a very funny moment, though, where you, I can't remember who you're talking to, but you can, like, really go down the communist line and be like, I am... Like, the game is even like, are you deciding to be a communist? But then there are also choices where you're like, yes, I want to do this. Where you're like, and also kill everyone. Like, I want communism and I want to kill everyone. I was like, wait a second, what is happening here?
Right, well, that's, I mean, that's what's good about this is, like, I kind of, this game is good at making fun of communists in a way that, like, you know, Fox News would never be. You know, the fact that, like, It has to come from a place of, like, understanding what could be beautiful about this to then make fun of, like, how ridiculous it often is. And, like, a lot of the communism stuff in this game is really funny because you are, like, every other person who's ever tried this in history has failed, but I'm gonna be the one. I'm the guy.
So that was the first thing that surprised me when I walked out of the Whirling in Rags was the Cumtown references. I decided to keep playing the game, and I met a very interesting duo of characters. And the next thing that surprised me is how many homophobic slurs are in this game. An unbelievable, a record-setting amount.
Though they
for
do
a video game,
they do blur, like, censor them, which is interesting.
I did,
it's
in fact,
from one character, correct?
Yeah,
yeah, well, from those Kuno, two.
Kuno.
Yeah, I went and met Kuno. As AJ Moser has said, his favorite character, which I was like, what an unsurprising choice there from Mr. Moser, who I'm sure can hear me saying this right now. But yeah, I did find the light of my life, Kuno, who I love, speaking of the third person being the worst human on Earth.
Experiencing Kuno for the first time in this game was, I mean, I had several moments of being like, oh, this game is good. We didn't even talk about the very opening where you're just being talked to by your, like, ancient reptilian brain and the limbic system, which is, like, those voices, I think, are
so good.
So some of the top voices in video games. But experiencing Kuno and then having Kuno West be like, throw the rake at him, Kuno! It's like... It is really like a kind of curveball that you don't expect the game to give you. Is you're like, I'm going to inspect the bodies, and there are two children yelling homophobic slurs at you.
Also, the accents in Revachol are so confusing because there's like Kim Kutsuragi, who is, you know, Asian. There are plenty of people who are like have French accents, but then there's these two kids who just seem like very like I don't know, Cockney, like very deep UK, like what is, but they're all from this city. Am I thinking too hard about this specific thing? But like the accents have been very confusing to me.
Raz, do you have a take on this?
I wonder if it's just supposed to be that melting pot idea, right? Of this is a place where people end up and then stay.
That is basically my take on it, you know, that it is this melting pot. I mean, it's like Martinez and Revachol and all of these have a lot of history. One of the interesting things about it that I would assume you kind of ran into some of these ideas is like you basically find out that the city you're in had like a failed revolutionary movement where they, like,
yeah.
You know, they attempted a revolution and then were like really violently put down by the government.
Yeah, you can meet the old Revachol nationalist.
Right.
That is playing the game and you throw his ball, which is very funny.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of history around, and some of it you will learn, and you know, and some of it kind of stays a mystery. An interesting thing that I did once, and I didn't complete the game like this, but I played a modded save of this with all the skills maxed out. And so when that happens, you hear every line that every voice could say, and it's like the encyclopedia skill is like a machine gun that it just like keeps giving you information like so much, and it is completely overwhelming. But like, if you want to, you can learn a lot about the whole thing.
So I met Kuno and I was like, Jesus Christ, what is happening? The body I spent some time with, I almost find the body not super compelling in this opening. Like, I liked exploring it and talking to it, but I think, like, because the game is throwing so much at you, it's like, well, the interesting stuff with the body, I'm sure I will get to later. Right now is just kind of this, like, big question mark, and I was, like, more compelled to explore and talk to people.
I want to know what you did with the body. Like, is it still in the tree?
It is still in the tree.
Okay.
Yes.
But you did manage to not throw up and, like, inspect it?
I threw up, but I can't remember the exact steps I took to get to the point where I inspected it, because I got the whatever.
Like ammonia or something.
Ammonia. Mm-hmm. I sniffed that, and I think that's what finally got me there. I can't quite remember, but I did inspect it. I talked to it for quite a while. And right now, I have no real conclusions on what's going on there. So moving on, I want to talk about the part of this game, Jacob. I know that you did not see Rez. I'll be very interested to see if you have gotten deep in this.
Oh, wait, actually, before you do, can we talk about Kuno just a little bit more? Before we move on? So I've got, my playthrough has a lot invested in the skill Half Light, which is essentially this like extremely aggressive physical. I don't even really know what Half Light refers to, like what that is referencing, but when I met Kuno and Kuno's fucking roasting me, Half-Light was like, kill him, fucking kill him, just kill this kid.
Oh, and, dude, I had to talk my character out of punching him.
Okay, and I did punch him. I knocked his ass out.
Like, I had to really fight with the game to be like, do not punch this fucking kid. It was hard.
It's really funny. It's like, the thing is, if you punch him, he, like, does respect you more. Like, it does, like, work. Oh, but wow. Kim gets mad. Kim is like, you cannot do this. You are a cop.
Holy shit. Wow.
Also, before we move on, Dick Mullen aside, the conversation when you call your the like headquarters, the police headquarters, is
it's
one
so
of my
funny.
Favorites in the game, because there keep being new voices that come in that are like, wait, what's he doing? He lost his badge? And they're like, yeah, he lost his badge.
They all have to filter through this very by-the-books operator who is like the middleman of this conversation. It's so funny. It's very, very good.
Yeah. Okay, so you went somewhere interesting.
Yeah, so I don't mean to throw a lot of day one out the window, but like a lot, if you're playing this game, you'll realize a lot of day one is walking around to people, getting new tasks, and not really knowing who they are or what their significance is yet. And I don't think we need to go through the laundry list of everyone I talked to, but like, you know, I talked to like the guy on the scaffolding and the scab leader and all these people. And I was like, okay, I do not understand who they are yet. I threw the old man's ball and then I was like, well, fuck, I gotta go find them a new ball. But at one point, I decided to go check out a bookstore. And I talked to this little girl outside. I'm like, you know, I'm like, I went down this really interesting path with her to just be like, hey, why aren't you in school? Also, like, why are you chewing your nails? And I went and talked to her mom and, like, you know, I explored the bookstore and found the entire Dick Mullen section. I was like, oh, there's the fucking Dick Mullen section. But there are a lot of really funny stuff with the books you can find. My dog is going ape shit back there right now. You know, and I like confronted her about her daughter, and the mom is really interesting because she seems like very uninterested in literature entirely, which I think is like a very interesting character for her. Also, like, even when you get her to apologize to her daughter, she seems like more or less apathetic to what she's doing. Like, she's a very interesting character. The only thing she fucking cares about, though, is this supposed curse on the shopping district she works in. And I'm like, now that's interesting stuff. She has a curtain. The only time you'll get any kind of, like, genuine reaction from her is when you go to this curtain and she thinks you're going to look behind it. So, of course, I rip it down. I break character. I'm like, I'm going back here, lady. I rip the curtain down. I was like, I have to know. And I nearly killed myself opening the door, only to later kill myself right. kicking a steel gate. But I break this door down, and it was one of the only, outside of like menial tasks throughout the game, like I found a narrative thread I could really follow, which like opened up and I was able to like see all the permutations, which I know is going to be there later in the game, but this was like the first like big thread I was for able sure. to go down, which as far as I could tell, it felt very side questy, you know, like almost secondary, but I was like, let me just see how deep this goes, we'll see if it loops back around later. And but it was like that moment where I go back there and realize I can explore this entire building and multiple stories will tell themselves that will build into like the history of this building, that I fell in love with the game. Because you go and you come across like an abandoned gym and like everything's still there, and you go up the stairs and you like you come across a very interesting former like office of a they're not even like a tabletop role-playing company, they're like they're trying to make this world's equivalent of an online game that you would play a role-playing game over the radio waves in this world.
Yeah, okay, I want to talk about this.
You can end up finding their production schedule that they fell behind on, you can find their character sheets, like you can get really deep into the world of this stuff, and I was like completely sucked in.
Yeah, okay, so I think you are totally right in identifying that like this is a self-contained story in the way that like most other stuff that you're getting is not. That just seems like it could kind of spiral out endlessly, but this is like these guys are here, you can learn everything about them, and it is, you know, I think it is a pretty transparently like allegorical section to like what the developers of this game were actually experiencing, and they have said as much, because there's a section in this where it's like a role-playing game that you would do through like phone lines, and they're talking about like connecting to different like switchboards and whatever, but there's a section where they talk about how your character could like have different heads, and there were like they realized that like when they started having these different options, it was spiraling out into like millions of possible like permutations of the same character. And they have said explicitly that that is the thought cabinet of this game. Have you interacted with the thought cabinet at all, Blake?
A little bit. That's the one where you like choose a thought and you have to wait for it to like conclude.
Yes.
I've done 3 of them and I've been trying to figure out how to unlock more of them.
Short answer, you can unlock more slots with skill points. Oh, like you okay. do it. But Raz, do you have feelings about the thought cabinet from like a role-playing perspective? Because I think it is so interesting in kind of a way that I have not seen games do before.
Can you refresh me on the thought cabinet? I remember doing this entire side area and I remember this place, but I can't remember how much I interacted with the thought cabinet. What is the basics of it?
Yeah, so the thought cabinet is, you know, it's separate from this role-playing game, except in that it's, you know, it's connected through whatever. They're talking about something in the game they're making that's similar. But essentially, it's like you will be talking to someone and they will say something that triggers a thought in you. And so that can be like if you say something like communist sympathizing, get like, okay, you know, the communist thought. But then what's really interesting is you can choose to dwell on that thought more. And while you're thinking about it, it gives you kind of, it adjusts your stats somehow. And then once you've internalized it, it adjusts your stats in a different way. And you don't know what the final result is going to be until you've done it, which is is just such a kind of cool idea. Is like you don't know what internalizing communism or like there's one called like volumetric shit compressor that's like when Kim is like you have to get your shit together, and then you can like think about that for a long time, and then it will like cause something to happen to you. And I think it's personally, I feel like it is almost the best kind of role-playing in this game, because you're not picking them because of the stats, you're just picking them because they're things you find interesting.
Yeah, sorry, I did not remember the name, so I was envisioning, like, a machine within the right. RPG thing that was called the Thought Cafe. Like, I have very little memory. Okay, but yeah, that whole aspect of it. Well, what I like about it is, I mean, obviously, it makes things you do and decisions you make feel like they have value, because that will unlock different thoughts that can come up. I think what's interesting about it from a role-playing perspective is this is a hard thing to implement in something like D&D, because... like, you can try to, you know, pull your players along of like, oh, is your character thinking about this a lot? Like, you know, have they changed, you know, how they view these things? But if you're trying to put that on them, it feels like you're controlling their character, right, as a DM, instead of them choosing, like, this is how I want my character to grow, right?
Right.
I want my character to change in these ways. I think by having this be, like, a mechanic... of like, based on the decisions you make, you can think about this more. And these are the things. It like encourages character growth and character change, without it feeling too heavy-handed, I think. Because you can always not think about it, mm-hmm. you know, or think about a different thing. I think it's cool. And I think you're right that the mystery adds a decent bit to it. Of like, well, I like how this thing is right now.
Right.
But what if I, like, what happens if I don't later on? I think these are really cool RPG mechanics. I have not played a TTRPG with something like this. I feel like the issue is I haven't played a game that has a system similar to this. So if a DM just tried to do it out of nowhere of like, hey, you've been thinking about communism a lot lately. You know, take these stats. The player might be like, well, no, I don't want my character to do that. So I, you know, I guess it's maybe less of a problem with it being like it's not that it's impossible to do it in a tabletop RPG. It's just, I guess, about having the systems for it.
I don't know if I'm getting a little off track here, but I think if there is one thing with all the various RPG systems, especially going on in the background, that I do find frustrating, that's like, I don't really feel like I need the game to be like over tutorialized and telling me what each thing does, but it is like, I just wish I knew a little more how they work. Does that make sense? Like a middle ground between that opaqueness and just knowing like what these menus, which are, when you open up the character sheet, it's inscrutable. Like you look mm-hmm. at it and you're like, your impulse is to close it because you're like, I don't want to fucking deal with this. I wish there was just like 20% more transparency to understand if I'm, like, if I have chosen the character I want to roleplay, sometimes it feels like you were grasping at straws with the systems to know if you're actually doing the right thing, which can feel a little bad because it's like, well, shit, I didn't understand the system all the way, and now I think I did, like, a choice I wouldn't have naturally.
I think that is mm-hmm. that is totally fair, and it is, you know, it is, like, the constant balancing act of, like, you almost don't want to understand the game mechanically too much because... like a good DM, it seems like you shouldn't be able to like game it. You know, you should just be kind of like making decisions and then it makes decisions in return or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is, I do know that feeling, and I remember it from my first playthrough of just kind of being like, oh, I don't think I would have put like a point
right.
there if I really understood right. what was going on. I do want to bring up something like that we love talking about, which is everything in a game is storytelling.
Oh,
the artwork in the Thought Cabinet is some of the craziest shit you have ever seen. And it's like, it's in the background, but if you look up like what the full Thought Cabinet actually looks like, and they like sell this as prints or whatever,
yeah,
it is unbelievable.
Is it the thing they use as the OST album art?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about, we should talk about the aesthetics of this game a
little
bit.
Both.
Okay, no, we shouldn't.
I'm still talking about this damn shopping center.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, first off, just talking real quick about the tabletop role-playing company as a analogy for, what? How do you pronounce their name? Zaum? Z-A-U-M?
Zaum, yeah, I don't know.
The developer of this game. Mm-hmm. There's a really great Kim quote where he says, it's as if the less money they had, the more ambitious their project became. I know doom when I see it. The company was running out of funding. And I was like, huh. I can read through the lines here. But you keep going. You soon find a ice cream company that has failed because they used a taxidermy bear as a refrigerator. I'm currently trying to get into one of the freezers right now. I'm trying to get it to thaw because it was frozen shut, so I unplugged it. And Kim was like, why would you do that? And I was like, I don't know. Come on, game. Be a little smarter. What do you mean, why did I do that? It seems pretty obvious to me. Eventually, you, like, so there's this idea that there's a witch in the top of this building. And it turns out she's actually just a dice maker.
Yeah.
That people can hear talking. And she will dispel the common myth that this shopping center is cursed. She's like, no, these are just the dumbest companies that have ever existed. And I only exist because I don't have to pay rent because I'm in the literal chimney of this building. Mm-hmm. But you can go back and talk to, I think her name is Pleasance, the bookstore owner. Uh-huh. And like, despite trying to play this as a kind and empathetic character, there are some people in this game where I'm like, you know what? Kind of fuck you. Like, yeah. I don't want to deal with your shit. And like, Pleasance is like exploiting her daughter and like just like blaming shit on Hocus Pocus. And I'm like, listen, lady, just a bunch of companies in here were idiots. Like, there was an ice cream company up there which put their ice cream in a dead bear. Like, there's no curse. Mm-hmm. Like, you're all just dumb. And you're dumb for opening a bookstore in a cursed building. I'm sorry. The lady upstairs is just making dice. Get over it. And I completely obliterated my relationship with that character because of it. The game was like, you fucked up. Nope, this character hates you.
Here's the thing that I love, though, about the way that this game does, like, world building and whatever, though, is that, like, it's true that you get to that woman, she's in the chimney, she's like, they're idiots, there's no curse. But if you, and I think this is passing some sort of check, you can eventually realize that, like, she is not actually in the commercial district. Like, she's, the, like, chimney that she's in is technically a part of the building next to her. So it, like, it does not actually dispel the idea of, like, the myth or the curse, because, like, she's not in the cursed building. She's in the building next door.
So there's one prompt left, and I haven't rolled it yet because it's, like, one of the chance ones, and I wanted to get that stat a little higher because I didn't want to fuck that one up with her.
No.
Okay, that's interesting to know. I'll definitely have to go back and find it. However, wrapping up my thoughts on this cursed commercial district, this game reminds me so much of Dishonored in so many ways, the Dishonored series. Aesthetically, the world building of just an entire, you know, series of continents you'll never see, but they exist in the text of the game. And also, the Dishonored series, also just RPGs, are very famous for, like, the environmental storytelling or the little threads you can follow that have nothing to do with the main quest, but they're there if you want to. I think where this game is brilliant is, like, you don't go through the building and learn one story. Like, I don't know, maybe because of just the way a building is composed, you learn, like, a metaphorical sandwich of stories.
Yeah.
That I thought was so brilliant that they were like, if you're interested in busting this one door down, which may kill you, which did kill me at one point trying to break this door down, you can learn six different sub-stories at once. You don't just learn about a gym or a tabletop role-playing game. You have to, like, keep track of, like, an entire history's worth of people in this building. And I found that so fascinating. It was the moment I was like, oh, I love this game. And I'm excited to finally pull out the main narrative threads. You know, because day one, you just don't get a lot of that, except for right here.
While talking about the dice lady, can we talk about how dice is used in the game?
Yeah, talk about rolling.
Yeah, let's talk about rolling. All right. So I think Disco Elysium uses an interesting system. It's a 2d6 system, which, you know, you roll two very normal die, the ones you're most used to rolling. The most, like, popular TTRPG system out there is a d20 system, mostly because that's what Dungeons & Dragons uses. Which is just you roll a 20-sided die and the number on it is what your number is. And like, that's obviously iconic for people who play games. You roll a nat 20, you're like, that's the greatest feeling in the world. I've succeeded. You roll a nat 1, you're like, I'm an idiot. I suck. The thing about it that the big difference between the two systems is with a d20 system, you have a 5% chance to roll any number, Like, you have just as good of a chance to roll a 20 as a 1. But in a 2d6 system, like, you're probably going to roll a 7. Like, that is just going to be the most common
one. That's interesting. Oh, I have not thought about this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, the highest... I made a chart beforehand. But, like, to roll a 12, which is the highest roll, you have, like, a 2.7% chance of it. And to roll a 2, which is the lowest. And I think in Disco Elysium, a 12... in almost every case is an auto success and a 2 is an auto fail. So you have like just under 3% chance of auto success or auto fail, where it's like 5% in a D20 system, mm-hmm. Which is significant. I think it's good that they make it so you have less of those automatic successes in this game, because it kind of would go against the game if you just had a 5% chance all the time to get something. I think that'd feel weird.
Yeah, a 3 feels a lot lower than 5. Like, when you see that 3, you're like, so 0. I got 0 chance.
Yeah, but, like, the bulk of your rolls will be 5 to 9, which I think gives them some wiggle room to play around with numbers, because they can kind of predict what you will roll on a skill check, right? You're probably going to roll a 7. So then when you're establishing, you know, how hard the checks are, right? There's like trivial, easy, and goes up all the way to impossible. It's just they can predict it with a little more consistency. And I think that gives them some chances to write around it in fun ways that is harder with a D20 system.
That's really cool. And there are checks in the game where it feels like it wants you to pass it in kind of an interesting way, where, like, and they're the ones that I'm thinking of are like actually much further on in the story, but like they will juice the numbers, and sometimes you know it's like grab the tie is like one chance, but if you stop the fan from turning once and then take the tie, you have a greater chance because you like gave yourself a little boost. And so it's another way of kind of working around it. Or like, you know, there's a dumpster at the crime scene, and if you're really strong and get lucky, you can just pull it open with your bare hands. But like, obviously, if you use a crowbar, you're going to have like a way better chance of opening it. And so it's interesting how they kind of mix your skills, the inherent probabilities of the dice, and like actual doing things that are smart in the game, you know, that you can make things easier on yourself just by like thinking them through. Blake, are there any skill checks that you've like really wanted to pass that you failed?
Yeah, most of them.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. None. Unfortunately, none come to mind specifically, but like a lot at this point.
One that I had this run that I don't think I've ever had happen before is when you are with the body, there is an option to shoot it down. And I did it. I shot the body down.
You found his gun?
No, it's Kim. So, Kim, you say, hey, Kim, we should just shoot it down. And Kim's like, that's a stupid idea. And then he's like, God damn it. And he does it. And I think he always misses. And then you can do it. And it was like a low chance. But because my guy is spec'd very physical, so he actually like had... it was like a 45% chance or something of doing it, and I got it.
I don't remember exactly what the thing was, but I know I rolled something that I had like an 80 to 90% success on, and it failed, and I've never felt worse in my entire life. I was so bad.
That's that XCOM experience.
It was really bad.
Yeah. 90 means 100, I thought. Come on.
Yeah, I was under the impression.
And in XCOM, that often is the case. It's like 90 actually means like 96 or something.
Let me just tell you like my itinerary for day 2. Mm-hmm. I have talked to the lady on the boat who has made me her errand boy, whatever. But she has crucial info I want. So I'm going to go investigate this drug trade. Fine. The guy on the gate is very interesting to me, because the lady on the boat mentioned his tattoos. And I'm very curious about the corpse's tattoos and whether or not those things line up or whether or not he recognizes them. Mm-hmm. Whatever the case may be, I want to go back to the lorry drivers, figure out which one of them is transporting those drugs or whatever. And there's also a vagabond artist lady up somewhere. I can't, her name's the Skull or whatever. And she's the next nut I want to crack. I'm really interested in that lady. There was a funny moment where she was like, I'm going to do some graffiti up here. And I was like, love it. And then she was like, well, the cops like it. Now I'm not as into it. I was like, shit, oh, fuck. I didn't even think of that. So my itinerary is those three people right now. That's the first few things I'm going to tackle.
I think that sounds very cool. I'm excited. I mean, so like when you examine the body, like, did you as it's hanging, because you will, spoilers, you do a more thorough autopsy on it if you get it down from the tree, but like, was there anything that you found kind of interesting about it other than you can talk to it?
Well, definitely the gross descriptions of the decomposition process that ZAUM mm-hmm. put in there. I don't think it had really dawned on me the themes of the labor struggle of the game until I started like really thinking about who the body was and inspecting the body,
mm-hmm.
that some of that stuff came into play.
How so?
Well, at this point, I don't have anything deeper to say. I don't have any deeper knowledge about it, but I don't really think I knew that that's what the game was about until I started putting into context that, like, a murder has now happened at the same time there are these labor, not disputes, riots?
Mm-hmm.
What would you call it?
There's a strike, yeah, and there's...
Yeah, this labor strike, and that now there's a body. I was like, oh, okay, so there's really something interesting going on with the scabs and the union people if they're pushed to blood that I'm, like, really compelled to investigate further.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you go over to the strike, it's like, there's animosity and frustration there, but it seems somewhat civil. And I was like, okay, so, like, what is actually happening in this world that now one of these... What seems like one of these people is hanging from a tree.
Right.
And also, how much has Kuno fucked my autopsy up by throwing right, rocks at the body and causing numerous contusions across a corpse's body? So those are the things I'm kind of thinking about right now.
I'll tell you, I am committed this run to the boots that the corpse is wearing. Another slight spoiler, the full set exists within the game in like various different parts, and I've never assembled it all before, and I want to try that this run. If you try to take the boots off when the corpse is still hanging from the tree, every Kuno, like, it seems in my mental image of the scene, everyone just starts screaming because, like, it is very clearly like you are going to pull his head off. Like, if you keep pulling on the boots, then you are going to decapitate him. And Kim is like, you are going to pull his head off. And it's like, I made essentially half a video about how the corpse is treated in this game, but like, some of my favorite writing ever in any game is how this body is described, and I can't wait to talk about it more. But like, the thing where you talk to it and you ask who it was, and it has, first it has the voice of the like ancient lizard brain or whatever, and you say, who were you? And he says, like, a killer, a motherfucker and a killer. And then you're like, what killed you? And he's like, it was love or something. And it's like, God, that's so evocative. Like, that's so cool.
But he's not the only corpse you find in the fucking tree, Jacob.
Yeah?
Yeah, you find your own damn corpse in that tree.
That's right. Okay. So, okay. I want to run through just a couple more things that happened to me that I just think you probably won't get. There's a drunk guy in the... in the Whirling in Rags that has a spilled rum next to him, and you have the option to lick it off the counter, which I did. I clicked lick the rum on the counter, but only a little was the choice that I made. There's the guy who you can talk to at the strike, who's hanging out on like on the stairs, and he talks about, you say like, you can say that I'm a scab. And he's like, no, you're not. There are no cop scabs. There's never been a cop scab. Yeah. What would they say? Let us cop for less money?
Yeah.
which is such a good line. And then also, I have I have subscribed to fascism in my thought cabinet, but I'm still working on it. And then, did you go in the pawn shop, Blake? Because if not, then I'll save this for later.
No. I've not.
So that's all. There's I've done some interesting different stuff in my playthrough, but it's all stuff that I think you will get to in time. The end of the day, another one of those moments where I was just like, oh goddamn, I cannot believe the game is operating on this level. You're about to go to your room, and then Kim's like, hold on, let's talk about the day. And you just like walk out onto that balcony, and Kim lights up the one cigarette that he smokes every day, and the camera zooms way back, and you just talk about the day.
And I don't know if it's different for your playthrough, but for me, it was like such a human moment for Kim.
Oh, yeah.
Like he, I would hesitate to say he opens up, but he is not the face of stoicism he had been throughout the previous hours of interacting with him. Mm-hmm. That I was like, oh, wow, he's a real human being. Here. I mean, he's not, but you get what I'm saying.
It's interesting how vulnerability works different for different people, right? With someone like Kim, all it takes is you seeing he is the type of person who has a vice or needs a second to smoke a cigarette to relax, because he didn't seem like that person before. But that makes the walls, it really does make the walls feel like they come down a lot, even though he's still about as even keeled and distant as ever. But you're just like, I know him now. We're guys.
Yeah, and like seeing him, you know, like he really hasn't done anything because he enjoys it all day. You know, like nothing that you've done has been mm-hmm. like Kim wants to do this. And so being like, he really savors this cigarette. You know, he allows himself one cigarette every day and he likes it. And my God, the music, like, we'll get to this more, but, like, the outside theme of Revachol, especially, like, at night, is just, like, some of my favorite music and kind of atmosphere setting in a game. And so, like, this, it just feels so, I don't know, like, legitimate as, like, a detective story. Also, this idea of, mm-hmm. like, you really do feel like your partner's going over the case and kind of, like, here's what we did and here's what we didn't do and, you know, whatever. He makes you feel like a fuck-up for the things that you didn't accomplish, where it's like, okay, the body's still mm-hmm. in the tree and that's not good. But I think you're totally right, Raz, in just, like, seeing him indulge his vice just a little bit really does a lot of work.
There's also something about the moderation of it that's interesting. I remember in college like someone that lived on my dorm floor was talking about their daily routine, and they're like, yeah, every night I after doing, you know, my homework and stuff, I watch one episode of The Office, and that's like my treat to myself. And I'm like, bro, I watched season 2 last night. I watched like the whole thing. What are you talking? Why would you only watch one episode? I think it's like those different mindsets that people can have of like, oh, I want all the entertainment right now, constantly, all the time, versus I'm going to sparse this out, take it bit by bit, enjoy it and think on it.
It's weird you bring that up, Raz, because I had a weird flashback while playing this exact moment to my days in school, not college because I didn't do that, but high school. My health teacher, who was also our PE teacher, told us, we were learning about nicotine and tobacco, and he said, every night before I go to bed, I have my one pack of dip, and that's my treat to myself. He's like, I don't chew, I don't dip the rest of the day. It's right before bed. Right before I go to bed, I get the Jones, and then I dip. And that's the one I have right at the end of the day. That's my treat. And I was like, holy shit, Kim Kutsuragi is my health teacher. It was like uncanny.
My health teacher, who is also my PE teacher, told me that men were evolving twice as fast as women.
Do it that
way you will.
That same health teacher also showed us Basketball Diaries, and I'm not really, that's a great movie and I love Jim Carrey a lot. Not sure what that had to do with health.
Blake is not high school. Not only an alcoholic in recovery, but a former smoker. This game certainly, like, even in the very first scene, you can like find that cigarette and you get the idea of like, oh man, I should find more cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not smoking, though.
Damn. Cold turkey.
Here's the thing. And by no means do I think this is a typical recovery experience. But I feel fortunate to be in my place in recovery from alcohol. This year will mark 5 years. that I rarely think about drinking anymore in terms of like, I want to drink. I feel very fortunate. I can smell a cigarette from, I would wager, 10 miles away.
And you live in New York City.
I have not smoked in almost 2 years. And I swear the second I smell a cigarette, I'm like, I can smoke a carton right now. Like, I can smell alcohol all day. I'm like, I don't really fucking want that. Like, the lightest waft. And I'm like, think I'm gonna smoke a cigarette right now. It's crazy. So playing this game, that is the one vice decision. Not drinking, I'm like, I don't give a shit. But because of who I am, when the option to try to smoke comes up, it's so hard for me.
Like, and then say Kim's no. doing it.
Yeah.
And he looks so cool.
It's like, oh, God. It's like the one thing in this game that is genuinely difficult for me from a decision-making standpoint is like making my character not smoke. It's crazy.
There is a hardcore difficulty that I've never played on, which I think makes the skill checks harder and makes drugs and alcohol benefit you more but also hurt you more. So like in the main game, you're not really that pressured to do it. There are versions of mm-hmm. it where you're more so. It's something that I think is interesting, but I've never really tried. Okay, so finally, after you go over the day, you go to bed, you think, wow, the day's over, what an adventure I had.
There's some really evocative writing about trying to think while in bed and the way thoughts will immediately disappear and you can't remember them. That I mm-hmm. thought was a really brilliant touch.
Yes. I mean, it's like, what's hard to talk about this game in podcast form is like, there are constant just like little lines that I'm like, ugh, that's so good, that's so poetic, but it's like mm-hmm. you know, what am I gonna do, just like read 400 lines that I like from this game?
Yes, Jacob.
Like, I was trying to think of like a good contemporary example of another video game with the like narrative, I don't know the word, depth as this, or density, and like I couldn't think of one except for Nier Automata, which I think actually takes a lot more behind the scenes studying to understand what that's doing. But it really often feels like, aside from that one example, in a league of its own in terms of like popular games and just like how well written it is.
Yeah, I mean, Raz, I think you're the one of us three who's played Baldur's Gate 3. Do you how do you feel that compares?
I don't know that I've played enough of it, I say, having played 20 hours. I think it compares decently well. I think, again, I don't know. I've only scratched the surface of Act 1 of that game, so I'm sure there is a lot that I've not encountered yet. Which is funny, yeah. I've probably, total playtime, am close to how long it took me to beat Disco Elysium, but I feel like I know so much more of Disco Elysium. I think in some ways it has a similar level of I don't want to say depth necessarily, because it's not always trying to say as much as Disco Elysium is. Yeah, I guess density of what the options are and what the responses are, there is a
ton. It's like Baldur's Gate seems really invested in character relationships in a way that this game maybe isn't. But like, part of how novel-esque Disco is like, it just spends so much time writing about like the world and like the feeling of the air and kind of other things that you're mm-hmm. not necessarily going to get in more traditional RPGs, in more traditional settings.
Yeah, Nier is the one I kept thinking about, which I don't believe is as decision-based, but like the ways it handles like how deep into like philosophy and mm-hmm. it's like portrayal mm-hmm. of philosophers, which I would say the game does not put up front and center the way Disco does a lot of its ideas, but is the one I kept coming back to, being like, there is so much here if I wanted to like turn the game off and actually like read up, which I found like really cool and fascinating. Not something I feel a lot in the games I typically play.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to the point, like the comparison between Disco Elysium and Baldur's Gate 3, I think, you know, Disco Elysium, as you said, has so many of those just like little one-liners that are just so like, oh, like, God, I wish I had written that. You know, it's like it's like reading Neil Gaiman, and you're like, God damn you, Neil. Like, how do you always have something to say just in one sentence that you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to think about this for a year now. Baldur's Gate 3, I don't think, tries to do that as much, at least from what I've played. Because as you pointed out, it is so much more about character interactions and less of like quick ruminations about the world and how people work and how the brain works and how our impulses work.
It's a really poetic game, right?
Yeah. So I don't think I've played a game that manages to be as poetic and have as many varying things to say as Disco Elysium.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Kentucky Route Zero referenced earlier. An incredibly poetic game, but not what I would call dense. That game almost like it works through how little it gives you, where Disco is like drowning you in writing, where it's just like so much is happening.
I also think the focus is so different in a way that like Disco has to be that dense, because like Kentucky Route Zero is like centered on the self and like a state.
Yeah, I still think it's about a place, but in a different way.
I think Disco is like, I think it's about a place too. And I think it's the entire planet where right. Like Kentucky Route Zero feels centered on like a like specific geographical yes. location that I don't get as much from Disco.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So finally, the game's most surreal moment thus far is you have a dream where you walk out of Whirling in Rags. And you go up to the Hanged Man, and it's you, and you're hanging from the tree, and there's also a disco ball hanging above it, and you have a little conversation with yourself. Was there anything in this conversation, Blake, that really stuck out to you?
I think it's one of the better portrayals of self-loathing in this section, because it feels real. And I don't know, maybe I just was not, like, seeing the right prompts earlier in the game to, like, really drive home the sorrow of self-loathing that this character may have. A lot of them felt kind of tongue-in-cheek, like, I fucking hate myself, aren't I a bastard? But like, there's this moment where, or in this dream sequence, there's only you and your brain, and like the sadness of how this character feels about himself and the way he has like thrown away a lot of his relationships and like damaged them irreparably felt very real. And it felt, in the game's own twisted way, which is like very crass in a lot of respects, sorrowful and like sympathetic towards like not the specific character, but the type of actual person he has become, you know? And I think like, I thought it was really, really well handled in a way. I still think a lot of the addict stuff is a little suspect in this game. And, you know, it is what it is. But I thought this moment was like very, very like, well handled and put together without being like, oh, woe is you. Like, there's still a bit of like, you reap what you sow in here, without like, you get what I'm saying? Like, I'm just kind of repeating myself. But yeah,
I think your point on how self-loathing is shown in the game is interesting. How so much during the day when you're out and about, it is like that, oh, I'm such an idiot sort of thing. And that's like so true to life of like, hey, I'm gonna make a joke about how much I suck. And then you're in bed and you're like, oh, I fucking suck. Yeah. Like, I'm actually, you know, so it is in those moments where, it is just you, where you can't play it off as a joke around other people. It's not only a moment that makes you actually sit in it, but I feel like it's just such an accurate representation of how so many of us go about, you know, hating ourselves.
Yeah.
I also like really like the line, you can still feel your wife's hand on your face. Which can mean so many different things, and the game is not.
Yeah, clear we have about not talked about the whole ex-wife thing, and we will get to it, I'm sure.
I love the idea that line can be like read sensually, or as she slapped him, or whatever the case may be. Like, I love that line. I think it is so, so good.
Yeah, I love that the character that you're talking to, though it is like clearly you and it's wearing your clothes, like in the dialogue it is bloated corpse of a drunk, you know, that it is like that's how the character is labeled, and it is like this almost refusal to kind of recognize yourself. And also the fact that it's like, well, it's not Harry, it's like, you know, his worst feelings about himself or whatever. I really like the line, and also the voice of the body is very good. Is it 4.6 billion people and you failed every single one of them? Which is this like catastrophizing of his failures to like, not only did I fuck up myself, but like the entire world. And that's where this ends. They you don't want to wake up and the ancient reptilian voice or the limbic system says time to go to work in the shit factory, which is sometimes how waking up feels. Blake, I'm so glad that you like this. It's been a long time since we've played a game I feel like that you've been like fully in on.
That's not true, Jacob. That's not true.
Okay.
We played Anatomy.
That's true. Like... Well, you did tell me that you were gonna like arrest me for making you play that game, even though you liked it.
It's too scary, man. I don't know what to tell you. We played two games I didn't like, but I tend to like the games we play. This game's great. You know what? I feel like it's a good antidote to Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2, which were like games I was so sure I was going to like, you know, based on everything I'd heard about them, and they just didn't land. So it was nice to be like, a game everyone said I was going to like, I do
right.
like. So it's nice to play this after the MGS games, for sure.
Raz, in the, I guess, 3 years since you've played this game, has it... I don't know. Has it like settled into, for me, I think of this as like, oh yeah, Disco Elysium, the best written game, you know, just kind of period. And that's like where it lives in my head. Do you have a kind of superlative or whatever that you attach to it?
I mean, obviously best written is such an easy one to lean on. I feel like it is probably the game that deserves a replay most of anything I've played. I feel like, and also that I would probably get a lot out of it because it would be way, way different, especially if I chose something that intentionally was different. So I don't know. Maybe my superlative would be the game deserving a revisit.
Games you can replay.
Games you should replay.
Even. Hey, as we're wrapping up, I wanted to recommend that video. I love that video you made.
The one about not being able to replay things.
Yes. I think about that video all the time. I have a superlative.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm ready to call it the best written game I've ever played. I'm so early in it, mm-hmm. and it's not Yakuza 0. I can buy into the replaying it because I already am like thinking about how I would replay this game. If anything, it's certainly the wordiest game I've ever played.
That is true.
There you go.
Well, until next time, in which we will be playing until day 3, we hope that you enjoyed this little introduction to Disco Elysium, and we enjoyed having Rasputin on the podcast quite a bit. Raz, thank you so much for coming on. You are, after Patrick Willems, the second Nebula person we've had on the pod. Something Ooh. Rotten is a Nebula podcast. Rasputin is a channel that has lots of fun bonus stuff on Nebula. My partner and I watched the video of you and your wife naming her favorite games, which is one that I highly recommend to everyone. What else do you want to plug?
No, that's, you know... Check me out on Nebula. Specifically on
That's
Nebula.
That's right. Nebula.tv/Rasputin.
I have a second channel. Let's plug the second channel. I talk about the games I play every month. It's been an interesting undertaking of like chronicling everything I play. Got to find a way to write things off on my taxes without feeling bad about it, you know? I have a second channel just called Raz, where if you just want to hear some quick thoughts about every game I play, you can do it there. That's also on Nebula. It's also on YouTube, but it's
That's
also
right.
on Nebula.
Thank you again for coming on. Blake, it was a pleasure to talk about Disco Elysium with you. Mm-hmm. And until next time, hey, everyone. You've never heard of a cop scab before, and you never will.
Bye.